Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 19th year. This podcast is sponsored by ICE Barcelona, January 20th through 22nd, 2025, at the Fira Barcelona Gran Via. ICE Barcelona is the complete platform to drive revenues through innovative solutions, technology, valuable insights, and unrivaled networking opportunities. To learn more, visit icegaming.com.
My guest today is Kate Spilde, a professor at San Diego State University and a jack of all trades, pretty much, when it comes to gaming and certainly Indian gaming. Kate, it's great to see you. I want to start by talking about the time we met. You were working for the National Gambling Impact Study Commission, and I was following them around wherever they went, and we became pretty good friends then. I think some of the research you did there really turned the tables in terms of how the commission viewed Indian gaming in particular.
Well, yes. Can you believe it's been over 25 right. years since I hit the scene? I know you are already an expert, but we didn't know that much at the time about the ways that the political structure was going to evaluate gaming. And certainly I think one of the things that, I was able to contribute, since I was one of the only people who had systematically studied gaming as a PhD dissertation topic at the time, I was kind of one of the first, certainly the first in tribal gaming, was when we look at the makeup of who was on the commission, we could see right away the lenses that they were going to use.
Right, right.
So for example, Bill Bible was there, so they were going to look at and evaluate the different industry segments according to regulatory rigor, if you will.
Right. Bill Bible had been the chairman of the Nevada Gaming Control Board.
Right, so there was a real focus on some forms of gambling are well-regulated, some are poorly regulated. Of course, how were we going to determine that?
Right.
But that was one of the measures. The other, of course, was unions and employment.
Right.
Like, does a lottery employ that many people, and are those good jobs versus an integrated resort in Las Vegas, which has many jobs and many union jobs? So again, employment quality and quantity was another metric that was kind of being imposed on the study commission.
And the member there that represented the unions was John Wilhelm, who is the president of the local culinary union in Vegas and the national union, that's the umbrella union.
Right, the HERE as well. So that became a big focus. And then, of course, we had Dr. Dobson and several others who were very concerned about social impacts, like in particular addiction or bankruptcy or things that they felt were affiliated with the introduction of gaming. Specifically casinos, I think, were targeted. And so we needed to really contextualize that as well and look at cause and effect, and whether or not there was a correlation or a causation. So again, sort of this idea of problems, social problems, problem gambling in particular. So then the different segments were evaluated on those dimensions as well, where things like convenience gambling in the grocery store was more addictive than an integrated resort or a tourist destination resort, where you had to make an effort to actually find the place and go there and gamble. So again, we had Terry Landy and others who represented many of our...
Chairman of the MGM at the time.
Yes, and he was able to, I think, shore up a lot of the work that helped us really show how each segment had different communities of interest, different social and economic impacts, and ultimately sort of rank them.
Yeah.
And again, I think that was one of the behind-the-scenes roles that I played, was helping... At that time, Frank Fahrenkopf, the founder and president of the American Gaming Association, set up the research agenda needed to look at those dimensions, and then also work with the tribes kind of behind the scenes, saying these are the things that the commission cares about. How can we be sure that we have research to show how well-regulated tribal gaming is, or the social the way that we look at social problems and address them in a preventative way. So it was a really exciting time, as you know, out on the road.
Yeah, we went to so many cities, Boston, Chicago, California, the Del Mar Racetrack in California, and Mississippi and Atlantic City. So it was an exciting travel agenda
very,
for us anyway.
But
I always thought the chairwoman of the commission, Kate James was really very good at reeling people in and keeping people on point, and also making a relationship between all the commissioners that was respectful. And nobody was you know, railing. Nobody was out there, you know, putting out, this is we have to do this. And I think that would be reflected in the final report.
It really was a measured outcome. Again, there weren't that many brand mandates. Right. It was much more of an actual research report.
Right, yeah.
And again, I think that really says a lot about the AGA and NIGA, that they were able to just, produce so much research and then frame it as, we need to know more before we can create mandates,
right.
Which isn't always the case with government study commissions, as we know, which often do have a very solid agenda.
Right, no question about it. So that was a fun time, and then you went on to get into academia, and you've done a great job. You had me down there speaking to your class 1 year, and it was a lot of fun. You've turned out some people who really become important people in the industry.
I am thrilled with the Sequan Institute on Tribal Gaming at San Diego State. I had several other positions after we finished the report, which again is coming up on 25 years that the report itself was issued. And again, what I love about that experience was that it did reveal what we didn't know, and there was so much we didn't know, and so who should be doing it. So I did first go to NIGA, and then NIGA, now the Indian Gaming Association, and set up their research and data center. So that was a thrill to be able to get to know all the tribes.
Right.
And like you said, back then, even to give credit to all the commissioners, it was just a different time in politics. It was across the aisle.
Yeah.
People really wanted to ask and answer policy questions.
Sure. Right.
So I feel grateful that I was there at that time, because that did set me on a course and on how I think about politics still, with tribal and state,
right,
or federal and tribal. And so I've seen the system work, and I crave that, and I want to try to keep that going in the research.
I can't imagine what a commission like that would be like these days. You know?
Exactly. I hope we don't have another one.
Right. But we won't have Frank Marikoff to figure out, who to put on the commission or help to get him on the commission. But as I was speaking to Bill Miller about this, he said, in those days we only had really New Jersey and Nevada politicians that could stand up for the industry. But now, gaming is legal in 46 states or whatever it is. So we have a lot more support, in Congress for that kind of thing. So hopefully we won't have to face that again.
Absolutely. And again, I like to give tribal gaming really a lot of credit for that, because we have so many properties.
Sure.
I mean, over 450 properties.
Sure.
So that so many communities have seen the spillover effects, the benefits in particular, that it's become just a part of the fabric of America.
Yeah.
Rural America, suburban America. It's a very natural part of our entertainment landscape. So there's, and people really perceive the benefits when they live nearby, whether it's employment, education, infrastructure, cultural improvements, just being able to go to a good concert or a good restaurant.
Sure.
People's lives are better. And we certainly know during COVID shutdowns, people missed these things so much. The gathering, ability that we have in these beautiful properties, tribal and non-tribal, but I think sort of the ruralization also just exposed so many more people to the benefits of this industry.
So let's talk about sports betting and online gaming now. Obviously, tribes want people to come to their casinos. That was really the main reason for the legalized tribal gaming, because they can get revenue from there. So they were afraid of sports betting and online gaming, because that would make people stay home. Even if they make some money off of it, they would rather have them come to the casino and rent hotel rooms for those that own hotels and eat in their restaurants, things like that. And of course, learn about the culture. That's always a aim of any tribe that has casinos. So why have they've not been able to figure this out yet in terms of how it will benefit them and how it will be able to maintain their visitors to their land-based casinos?
Well, again, I think it's just like the state-based sports betting or iGaming. Some of our tribes, there's no tribal gaming, right? It's very individual. Every tribe has its own solutions, its own questions. It's the relationship it has with the state, the relationship it has with its own local gaming, population already with their land-based casinos. But I think you kind of, the answer to your question is in your question, which is, tribes really are about hospitality.
Right.
They do want people to come and to welcome them to Indian country.
Right.
And there is a whole other dimension that isn't just about the business.
Right.
It isn't just about the profit or the revenue. Certainly that's the goal. The purpose is nation rebuilding using gaming revenue. But there is so much more. And,
right.
and I think that is a disconnect still about what tribes really want. And they want to welcome you. They want you to stay. And to learn and to visit other, whether it's the golf course and seeing the mountains,
right.
or go fishing up in Minnesota where I'm from, go boating, down in some of the tribes that are in Louisiana, for example, have beautiful marinas.
And right.
So I do think that there's still just a real commitment to that model, and so it's hard to get excited about something that doesn't contribute to that, because that has been 30 years, 40 years for some tribes in the making of just, this is what we're good at.
Right.
That sort of just tribal, native, special expertise in welcoming and in spreading joy and integrating with the local population. Particular. Again, it's so interesting. Some of the early days when I was out visiting tribes that were opening their casinos for the first time, the backlash at that time, it was interesting, especially in places like California where a lot of our tribes were on very small land base. Again, maybe 11 acres or, one square mile or just these tiny reserve lands. You would have local people say, this tribe came out of nowhere.
Right.
They were never here before, So there's still just this commitment to, we've always been here, the history and the welcoming. So it just feels much more like a business play to just be selling a gambling product online or to be taking bets on a game. So obviously, there's going to be an integration, a cultural match created, but each tribe is doing that. So it's just a little bit more painstaking than making just a business decision.
Right, right. So in California, where your university is located, there's been a lot of back and forth. There's been a couple of amendments. The tribes would control it, or private companies would control it, like FanDuel and DraftKings, and both of them went down in flames last time. Is there a solution there that will satisfy both parties?
Well, that's a great question. I wish I knew the answer.
Yeah.
I will say that, again, as an academic, what I'm thrilled about is that we do have a dedicated center at the Sequan Institute on Tribal Gaming. Again, we're really much more of the land-based. Again,
right.
I'm old school, and as an anthropologist, I'm supporting that host-guest model. But we are launching through a new professor that we have at San Diego State, Professor Brandon Mastro Martino. He has a vision, and I'm supporting him, as are the tribes and the companies, it's called the Swagger Center, Sports Wagering and Gaming Research Center. So those are the kinds of things that, public policy, regulation, around sports betting in particular, and iGaming, but sports betting is the most pressing, of course. This is the holy grail of the market with our 40 million, residents. And so we always want to attack it very deliberately, just like the tribes do, and support them and looking at all the scenarios. Again, just an easy thing like the early days of land-based gaming expansion, as you mentioned, when the NGISC was in action. we had like two commercial state models, and it was like, do we just take the, as it was known, the Las Vegas model or the New Jersey model and kind of expand that, or do we organically reveal something new for each state?
Right.
And I think the same is true for sports betting. You know, some states and some operators are saying, just tell us what to do and not do it so we don't violate any regulations. Whereas, you know, maybe a research project would say, well, what happens if we allow the industry itself to reveal what the regulations should be in each jurisdiction? Because Ohio is different than Massachusetts or California or Washington State or Michigan with regard to the sports betting climate and market and marketing. So those are the kinds of things that we would systematically study and teach in order to help the tribes decide what they want. Because again, we know there's a low margin. We know there's a lot of risk. Maybe not every tribe even would want to participate, but certainly we know in many places that the incumbents do have the most experience. And certainly in California, the tribes are the incumbents.
Yeah, that's what I said. So, in California, again, just recently, the governor signed a law that now permits the tribes to sue the card rooms, which is a milestone for them, because the card rooms are presenting some games that aren't really under the Indian compact than it is against the law. So how is that going to work itself out, do you think?
Well, I can't say, you know, the outcome. But I do know that for a long time, the tribes have been trying to encourage the state to, you know, actually regulate and impose, you know, the regulations properly. And it has been frustrating. And again, you know, there's no one tribal view on this. I will say that even, you know, one of our esteemed colleagues, Richard Schutz, who had been a California gambling regulator, and he was familiar with the tribal gaming regulation as well as card room regulation. And he's, you know, I'm not speaking out of turn because he did say this in public several times. He did say that, you know, tribal gaming was the best regulated form of gaming in California, where he was a regulator, and that the card rooms were regulated by prayer.
Right. That's true, yeah.
So I loved that he would make that comparison, and I think that did, you know, really empower the tribes to say, yeah, we know what we're doing, and we want to be sure that the state is doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Sure, right, exactly.
So it really is just about the, you know, the fairness issue, and again, I think that that's something else to consider when we're looking at the future of designing new regulations for a massive sports betting regulatory system.
Right, no question about that. And at the same time, we look at other states where tribes have actually entered the sports betting and iGaming market. In Connecticut, both the Mashantucket and Pequot tribe and the Mohican tribe is very, very skilled at their two sports betting and iGaming. In Florida, the Seminole tribe has a monopoly on sports betting down there with so many court cases that have gone through it. And finally, they got it, and they seem to be doing very well. I mean, can that be a model for other states?
Again, I think from a research perspective, we do have a lot of examples now. For example, in Michigan, the tribes actually got a state license, and that worked for them. So again, I hate to always go back to the same point, but each state, since it is kind of, you know, organized that way here in the United States, the tribes have to work within a state model, even if it's simply pursuing a prohibition, delaying a legalization, or you know, being the incumbents. Because of course, as we know, like you said, there are states that have commercial casinos and tribal casinos. There are states that have only tribal casinos, and each one of those then has to figure out the three governments, Is there going to be a federal angle? Is there going to, you know, in terms of the NIGC, the National Indian Gaming Commission, having some role? Is it going to be tribal and state, all three? And then each one is going to be different. So, you know, in some ways it's unfortunate, but just because we would like that harmonization that we hear so much about in Europe or other places. But on the other hand, it really does reinforce the fact that every tribe is different, and they have a very different set of overlays of which they had no control. What state was drawn around them, or where there's a, if there's a city nearby or not, or you know, their geography. So each one is responding to all these different variables. Right. And so what it does do is, as a, again, as an academic is, and as a policy person, is it gives us so many cases that we can get to best practices. I guess that's the next thing is, you know, I'm always hopeful that someday, you know, we've been here long enough, we've got enough examples, we've got enough case studies of what works and doesn't work. Can we ever put together like the right combination? And I do think we can.
Well, you mentioned the regulatory process, and a lot of people say the tribal gaming industry is the most regulated gaming industry in the country, because they do have those three levels, the state, the federal government, and the local government, and their own tribal commission as well. You know, we've seen NIGC, the National Indian Gaming Commission. They just lost their chairman. Did they appoint a new one yet?
They have Patrice Kunesh. Yes.
And now, you know, I have interviewed every chairman of the NIGC since the beginning, when Tony Hope was the chairman.
Wow.
Bob Hope's son.
Yes.
And it seems to have calmed down recently in terms of the conflict between the tribes and the commission. Is that regulatory capture? Do you think that they've really come to a mindset where they know exactly what needs to be regulated and what doesn't?
I do think that it's simply been tribes demonstrating their own capacity, and the NIGC realizing that while they, you know, like, for example, back in the 90s, there was a bulletin which was just, you know, kind of guidance for each tribe to, every tribe had to set up their own gaming commission. But the framework for that gaming commission was not dictated to them, because they understood that there was a cultural match that needed to happen. Maybe they have 7 members of their tribal council and they want 7 members of their gaming commission, or whatever. Do they want them elected, appointed? Should they be all tribal members? Should they bring in non-tribal members who have like a background in law enforcement? You know, what is the, every tribe did it differently, or at least where it had the opportunity to do it differently. There was no template. And that really respected the tribe's sovereignty, but let the tribes reveal that they were going to be really good at this, because they wanted to protect their own assets, the tribal assets, including their reputation, which is, you know, they can't just close down their business and start over. This is who they are, and this is representative of their government and their business at the same time. Well, to the point that NIGC recently updated that bulletin, but they still didn't impose a template. So I think that what they're doing is confirming that yes, we let this evolve. You've done a great job. We're going to keep building the partnership, but we're not going to give you a bunch of rules and then realize, you know, it's almost like a prevention versus a treatment model for a gambling disorder. Like, let's see what works so that we don't have unintended consequences because we overreacted and then have to roll it back and sort of treat something that's broken rather than work on it together. And again, I do think, you know, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act does require the 2 out of the 3 commissioners of tribal, and I think that does have a significant impact, because there is such a deep respect for tribes doing the right thing, especially with their own assets.
Well, this has been fun.
I'm thrilled.
Getting together with you, and usually it's just you and me talking, but
I know.
Now we can do a podcast.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real thrill. I'm so honored.
Well, good luck with the this new Swagger Center.
Yes, well, hopefully once it's launched, you can have Professor Mastro Martino on. He's a real expert.
No question. Well, thanks for doing this, and good to see you.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed today's podcast sponsored by ICE Barcelona, January 20th through 22nd, 2025 at Fira Barcelona Gran Via. ICE Barcelona is the complete platform to drive revenues through innovative solutions, technology, valuable insights, and unrivaled networking opportunities. To learn more, visit icegaming.com. To read more about the topic presented in this week's podcast, visit ggbmagazine.com. To subscribe to GGB's executive summary, go to ggbnews.com and sign up. Don't miss any edition of the GGB podcast. Subscribe on Spotify, Amazon, or Apple Podcasts today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB podcast.